When Helen Lewis was a little girl, one of her favourite places to play was in a small cupboard under the stairs at home. It was where her family stored bits and pieces, and for Helen, it was a perfect spot for imaginary games. One day, she found a battered old suitcase in that cupboard under the stairs. Helen clicked open the clasps and looked inside. What she found there, tucked away in an envelope, was deeply shocking. Helen shut the lid on that suitcase and clicked the catch. She didn't make a sound, and she didn't tell anyone what she'd seen. Hello, Helen.
Hello, Sarah.
Who lived at home with you when you were growing up, Helen?
Well, we were a small family. My mother, father, and my brother and sister, who were older than me. My memory goes far back as the first house we lived in, which was an outer suburb of London. A fairly isolated little family in many respects. I didn't know that at the time. As a child, you accept that that's the way things are. And when I was about 3 or 4, I think we moved to a new house in the country. My parents were great believers in the outdoor and the fresh air and wanted us to have space and rooms of our own and things like that. And so we moved there. And for me, that's probably the most vivid memories are of growing up in the small village in Essex, Little End it was called.
Tell me about your dad when you were a kid, Helen. What kind of sense of humour did he have?
Well, he had a pretty wicked sense of humour. Probably at times it could be a little bit cruel when he was teasing, and he would often tease us. One of his favourite teases was to take us shopping with him, and then when he had finished buying what he wanted and the shop assistant said to him, "Is there anything else I can help you with, sir?" he would say, "Oh, yes, could you give me one of those things for taking stones out of horses' hooves?" And it was terribly embarrassing. Children get very easily embarrassed by their parents, I think.
Whether he was at the butcher shop or the grocer's shop or the post office?
It didn't matter where he was. It could be in the chemist or buying a newspaper. It just, the mood would come upon him, and sometimes I would see that mood growing and I would tug at him and say, "Oh, Dad, please don't ask that, you know."
What did he want people to do in response, do you think?
Oh, I think he just thought it was funny, and I guess he wanted them to think it was funny, but I think it was also a bit of a wind-up for us as well.
What did he do for work?
Well, he was a news cameraman for the BBC. He was out a lot every day, mostly travelling up to London to film whatever it was that day that was the news. He was often away for long periods of time. And in fact, when I was very young, probably when we were still living at Geneva Gardens, I remember that he'd been away for probably 3 months in the US and Canada. And it was very strange because he came home, but I knew it was him, that he was my father, but he seemed like a bit of a stranger. And I guess that's quite a long period of time when you're a child. And, you know, I didn't really think anything of it until I went to school and got to know that other people's fathers didn't do that same kind of work and weren't away and were always there when they came home and that sort of thing.
When he was at home in the house, how much news was consumed at your place?
Ah, my father developed the 24-hour news service long before it was imagined. He would rise very early, probably due to his army career, so he was always up early. He would bring tea to us, but he would soon switch on the radio and listen to the morning broadcast of news and read the morning papers before setting out for the day. And then he'd come home in the evening, and of course he'd listen to the news, read the evening newspapers, and if he had a piece going to air, of course he had to watch it and critique it.
You must have had an excellent grasp of current affairs as a young child then.
Well, I think I did. I probably was precocious in that sense, but I don't think I really enjoyed it. I found it quite boring at times and at times quite confronting.
What story would he tell you about meeting your mum?
Ah, oh, that was always a lovely story. I thought it was very romantic. They met at the end of the war, just after victory in Europe had been declared. He was in the flying column that entered Copenhagen to liberate the Danes, and the place was in an uproar of celebration and happiness at this. As they drove into Copenhagen, people were throwing flowers at them and asking for autographs. And he got invited to a party, and there were parties everywhere, of course, in celebration of being liberated. And he got invited to a party by a young man who turned out to be the boyfriend of the girl that caught his eye. And as he described her, the girl more beautiful than Ingrid Bergman. And that's how their romance began. And I think he was only there a couple of weeks before he was reassigned and had to leave. But he was so enamoured of her and so convinced that she was the one that he had a red, single red rose sent to her every day until his first letter could arrive. At least he guessed when his first letter would arrive a few weeks later.
That is a beautifully romantic story. Mm. So did he talk much about his experiences in the war?
No, he didn't. And I think as I began to look into his background, into his early childhood and youth and into that period of his life, I realised how little he told us of his experiences in the war. I mean, I knew that he'd been a paratrooper, and I knew he filmed in Arnhem, and I knew that he filmed in Bergen-Belsen, but more than that, he really didn't share.
Tell me about that day under the stairs, Helen. What were you doing there, do you remember?
I remember that. Still remember that quite vividly. I used to like to go into this cupboard under the stairs. It was a little small place and it was full of junk and bits and pieces. But the reason I liked that place was because I liked to play imagining games. And one of them was to be Lucy in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, looking for the door into the magic land. And I imagined myself going in there and that the back of the cupboard there would be this opening. And I was the sort of child who thought that if I wished and thought it enough, it might actually happen. So this day I was playing under the stairs and looking at the various bits and pieces, and there was a big old metal suitcase there, and I decided to open it up and see what was inside. All sorts of papers and envelopes and bits and pieces, obviously documents and family bits and pieces. And there was one big brown foolscap envelope that was sealed, and being a curious child, I couldn't resist it, so I opened it. I carefully peeled it open and took out the contents, which were five huge photographs, and they were the most horrific things I'd ever seen. I don't know whether I knew then where they came from. I know now that they were of Bergen-Belsen concentration camp. These are the hard things to remember, because at the time I felt that I'd done something wrong, that I'd transgressed, because I'd opened an envelope that was sealed and clearly that was not meant for me to see it. So I put the photographs back into the envelope and tucked it into the layers in the suitcase and came out of the cupboard, and I never said anything to anyone from that point on. In fact, I never told my father that what happened. And it's really interesting because over the years, you know, I always remembered it, but it was always as if it happened to some other child. Mm. I would see it happening again, but it wasn't me in a sense. I knew it was me, but it wasn't me.
Do you remember how your brain made sense of what you were seeing? Did you connect it with the war, or did you connect it with your dad?
I think I did connect it with my dad. I think that I probably, well, Belsen in my life, in my memory, seems to have always been there. It's a very strange thing. When I look back, I can't really remember when I first knew about Bergen-Belsen and what happened there. It's as if I always knew about it. And I'm not sure whether those photographs were my first knowing of it, or whether I'd heard talk about it before, that he'd been to somewhere really awful and taken film there. But then, of course, later that memory became overlaid with what I came to know later as I grew older.
Your dad was Jewish, Helen. Tell me about his family. Was he raised in a religious household?
Well, I don't know much about his early life. A lot of that I had to recover from bits of pieces of papers and the odd documents I have. Really, there wasn't much, and my memories too, the little bits I had of his family. He was one of three children. His parents had fled from Poland, I think, at the turn of the century, probably from one of the pogroms that was happening there in Poland. And they were about 16 when they arrived in England, in London. They settled in the East End of London, and the three children, his sister Edith and Nancy, he was the youngest, and they made their way and they made their life there. I think that he probably had a reasonably orthodox upbringing, but as he grew older, he started to embrace a more secular life, and even changing his name, because his name was Michael Weisenberg.
When did he become Mike Lewis then?
Hard to say, really. Sometime before the war, he decided to change his name to Mike Lewis, and I think the Lewis was from one of his uncles whose name was Lewis. And he did that because he thought it would be easier finding work in the 1930s. There was still a lot of anti-Semitism, and sometimes that would make the difference between getting a job and not getting a job. And I think he also didn't want to be defined by his culture and his religion. So I think that it was sometime before the war, but in fact what I found was a statutory declaration of name change, but it was in 1946. So he went through the whole of the war under an alias, really. So that was very funny to find that out.
Growing up in the East End, did that mean he had a Cockney accent?
He must have had. In fact, he said he did have. And one of the things that was interesting when I look back, I think it was quite remarkable that he remade himself in lots of ways by discarding his Jewish name and even discarding his Cockney accent. Now, how he quite did that was quite a feat, but he taught himself to speak what we would consider sort of Queen's English or London English now, and got rid of that Cockney accent somehow, so that by the time I remember him, he sounded much like the British broadcasters of his day. And in fact, he was very vigorous in making us speak properly. If I asked him a question and he didn't think I'd enunciated my words properly, he would make me repeat it again. He didn't like me to drop H's or not sound the D's and the T's on the end of the word. So he said that was very important, because he said how you spoke marked you. And I guess in England at the time it really did.
What was it like to be Jewish in the East End of London in the 1920s and 30s? What kind of environment was it?
There was quite a large Jewish population in the East End of London, a lot of them moving there over a period of maybe 40 years up until the First World War. Successive pogroms or problems in the countries of their origin bringing them there. So by the time my grandmother and her future husband arrived, it would have had quite a Jewish flavour about the East End of London. There would have been lots of kosher butcher shops and bakers and synagogues, but yes, a very vibrant Jewish culture there.
And it became a target for anti-Semites in the lead up to World War II. Oswald Mosley, who was leader of the British Blackshirts, led marches there.
They call it the Battle of Cable Street. And when you look, there's a wonderful piece of footage on YouTube of the protest and the police on horseback and the protesters trying to push them out of the way and stop the march going. And they did stop the march going through the East End of London at that point. So, but my father wasn't involved in that, but he did go to a meeting afterwards to hear what had happened and to hear what was said about that. And so after the meeting, when he was walking home with his friend Harry, he was attacked by a mob of youths obviously supporters of Mosley.
So were attacked for being Jewish.
Yes.
Yeah. How soon after war broke out then in 1939 did your dad enlist?
About 8 months or so after it, I think, around 1940. So there was that brief hiatus after war was declared, which was often called the phony war. It wasn't very phony for people in Europe, I'm sure, but as far as the British goes, there was no actual engagement there after they'd rescued the remaining forces from Dunkirk. So he was called up into the infantry and joined, like lots of young men, and then was sent off to guard the coastline.
And then he went to join the Parachute Corps. How long had the Parachute Corps been around as part of the army?
The Parachute Corps was a completely new branch of the army that was ordered by Churchill himself. So he had heard reports of how the Germans and Italians and Russians had used paratroopers, and he thought it was a good idea that they should have paratroopers too. And so this was a time after the Battle of Britain and the Blitz and all those terrible things had been going on, and England was a bit like a fortress and they were expecting that Hitler could cross the Channel. So it was a bit like Fortress England had to do something. I don't know, maybe that was his thought. But anyway, I when I read about it, I thought it was a pretty grand gesture at the time to decide to set up a completely new branch of the army, because they didn't, I mean, I guess there were a few people who knew how to parachute, but there was no experienced people in the army that knew about these things. And they had to set it up from scratch, equipment, training, everything.
And what kind of training did your dad go through?
Well, there was a call for volunteers for the Parachute Corps, and my father, being quite bored with what he'd been doing so far in the war, which was basically, you know, I think marches and exercises and things like that, decided to volunteer. There was an interview. Many people didn't get past the interview because apparently they were looking for certain psychological traits.
Do you know what?
Well, intelligence, independence of thinking, that sort of thing, might not have been very welcome in other branches of the services, but they thought this was what paratroopers would need. And then when they got through that selection process, there was a sort of training designed to weed them out physically. And I gather it was very, very hard training. And also they tested them for things, swinging them from ropes to see whether they would get air sick and all that sort of thing.
Did your dad have a good head for heights?
Not at all. When I realised that, I was probably about 11 when I realised that he had fear of heights. We'd gone to the top of St. Paul's Cathedral. He'd taken me with him on an assignment. I can't remember what the assignment was, but he was filming there. And then he'd taken me up to this balcony sort of that ran around the outside. And I was looking out, fascinated to see all these different landmarks. And when I turned around, he was standing with his back pressed against the wall, and he said to me, when I looked at him, "Well, I don't like heights." And I said, "But you jumped out of planes." He said, "Yes, but I don't like heights." And I was astonished, really, and I thought, why would you volunteer to jump out of planes when you don't like heights? But I think that when he volunteered, he didn't think he would go through with it.
Was his Jewishness an issue in the army?
He doesn't say about his early part in the army, but it did crop up when he was in the paratroop corps, because just when he was going to do his qualifying jumps, he found that men in his hut were taking bets that he wouldn't jump because he was Jewish. I guess at that point it was nothing new for him. It had been painful, he said, in his youth, this anti-Semitism, something he found it hard to deal with. But the thing that changed his mind was the fact that he found out that there was another group who were taking bets that he would jump. And so he decided that his supporters would win and the others wouldn't. And so whereas he might have been happy to be RTU'd, returned to his unit, as they call that, he decided that he'd have to go through with it.
And he did the jump.
He did the jump, 7 qualifying jumps.
So once he'd qualified through doing those jumps, what uniform did paratroopers wear?
at that stage, it was really interesting because he says that as it was such a new branch of the army, they didn't even have their own headgear or arm patches or emblems, and they were just getting a little arm patch or arm flash at the time, which was a parachute with blue, a white parachute with blue wings. And that was a grail for these new recruits because that meant they were fully qualified parachutists. I think they got extra pay as well. And so that was the first item that defined who they were. And then I think they were given an arm patch, which was the Greek hero Bellerophon riding the horse Pegasus with a spear. And then later on, before they were sent to North Africa, they received the Red Beret, which became emblematic eventually of the parachute corps.
So his unit was first sent to North Africa. Was he involved in fighting straight away?
Not immediately. So there were three battalions sent out to North Africa. And this was the first mass deployment of the paratroopers. And the other two battalions were deployed first on quite successful missions. And so the aim was to take North Africa and meet up with the 8th Army, who were fighting their way through from Libya. And the paratroopers were being used sort of to push the land army on, or to sort of leapfrog it on. And then, so the first two were quite successful, and then he was involved in one himself, and that was at Depien, and that was an absolute disaster because the ground forces, the tanks that they were supposed to meet up with, never materialised, and they were left 60 miles or so behind enemy lines and surrounded by Germans and having to fight their way out and make a fighting retreat. It was a dreadful battle, a dreadful battle.
He must have lost friends, comrades in that battle.
Oh, a lot. I think only a third of the men that went in survived and got away.
Did he keep in contact with any of the families of friends that he'd lost there in North Africa?
In that particular battle, he had his first experience of actually someone was killed virtually right on top of him. It was terrible when he described it. And when I was listening to his oral history, it was the first time I'd ever heard him speak about that experience. And I thought, for a first experience of battle, how horrific that must have been. But then the paratroopers were used as ground forces after that. And eventually they ended up at Temara, which was one of the last major battles before North Africa was won. And he was badly wounded there for the second time in the North African campaign. And he lost his very special close friend, Fred, in that battle. And he found out, much to his dismay and horror, that it was what they call friendly fire. So he was killed by his own troops. Before they were deployed, he'd gone to visit Fred's family and his mother and so on, and he was so horrified by what had happened, and he wanted to do something, I suppose, in memory of Fred and for Fred's mother, that every year he would send flowers to her. I think probably on the anniversary of his death, he would send flowers to her, Mrs. Selman. When I was younger, it was something he just did, and I didn't know who she was, and it wasn't till I did the research that I put two and two together that that's who it was. But he sent flowers to her every year until she died.
Your dad was also wounded in North Africa, and when he was in Algiers recovering, he went for a meeting at the Hotel Aleti. What was that about?
After the second wounding, which was quite bad, he had quite a long convalescence in hospital, and then he was released for R&R, and he was spending some time in Algiers. He was feeling, I think, deeply sad at the huge losses of his comrades, the people that he'd come through. Of the originals, I think there was probably only a platoon left now. What they used to do was then bolster the battalion with new recruits, fresh from England. And he just thought that he wouldn't like to go back in those circumstances and that it would be very difficult. But he heard that the Army Film and Photographic Unit were going to set up an airborne unit and he wondered whether he might get into that. He was still not back on strength with his old battalion, so he thought he would try. And he had heard that a Captain Rignold, who was one of the first recruits to the Army Film and Photographic Unit, was going to be at the Hotel Aletti. And so he went there to meet him and to talk about whether he might get in. And Rignold thought that he had a chance and told him to go and see the commanding officer about whether there was a chance to get in, and that's what he did.
Had your dad had an interest in film or photography before this?
I'm not quite sure about his experience in photography. I imagine that he had some still photographic experience. He certainly had experience as an artist because he was quite talented as a young man, and he had been offered a place at art school, which he was unable to take up because his parents hid that from him because they wanted him to go out for work. So he obviously had a really good, highly developed visual sense.
This is Conversations with Sarah Kanoski on ABC Radio.
So, Helen, after your dad joined this new film and photographic unit, what kind of training did he get for that, and where did it happen?
Well, the initial training happened in North Africa, where he was still stationed, and he was trained as a cinematographer. And he also obviously did stills, because there are stills from North Africa in his diary, in his sort of visual war diary. And then he went to see a commanding officer of the AFPU who was visiting from England, who said, look, I'm going to send you back to Pinewood Studios in London. So that's what happened. He was sent via Algiers back to England to Pinewood Studios, where he did further training under somebody called Sergeant Penman.
And these were the centre of British filmmaking, yes. The Pinewood Studios.
Yes, the Pinewood Studios had been making films before the war, and it was co-opted during the war by several film units, one of which was the Army Film and Photographic Unit. And he did his training there. He learned about how to use the De Vrij camera, which was the one most favoured.
And what sort of camera was that? What was the equipment like?
Well, it's a funny thing about that. When I was reading the official war diaries, there were quite a few complaints from the Army Film and Photographic Unit about the equipment and how it really wasn't up to standard, and it certainly wasn't as good as the ones the Americans were using, and they didn't have, you know, good enough lenses and so on. I was really surprised when I was at the Imperial War Museum, they allowed me to pick up a De Vrij. It's a chunky little box of a thing with no particular grips for holding it, and of course, it was wound by clockwork, so you had to wind it to run the camera. And it was often called, or my father referred to it as, a coffee grinder. And the other name I saw was the lunchbox.
Was it heavy?
Yes, quite heavy, surprisingly heavy. And, you know, we're so used to being able to just whip out a phone and digitally take a photograph that it's really hard to imagine that this camera only took 100-foot spool of film, which was about 90 seconds worth. So part of their training was how to make the most of this, how to film a story. And one of the things he often said about himself was that he was a screen journalist, so he could make a story with a camera.
Were they reliable pieces of equipment once you got them on the field?
Not terribly. They did jam. That's another part of the training, was what to do, how to deal with that, because of course the film had to be removed in the dark and put into another can to keep it from being exposed. And so they would learn how to make a little dark room out of their jacket and do that without looking, and that was a skill to have. And luckily he did, because it happened to him in Arnhem that his camera jammed.
So having to do all of that with the camera in war conditions, I mean, it's just extraordinary. Did he carry weapons as well when he was having to lug around the camera and the film?
Well, no, obviously you couldn't carry very much if you had to carry a camera, and having to carry spare spools of film was also quite bulky. They came in metal cans, and so when he was sent to Arnhem to film the Battle of Arnhem...
This is in Holland.
Yes, this is in Holland. This was part of Operation Market Garden, the Allies trying to thrust now into Germany. September 1944, they thought that if they could make this concerted thrust across the Rhine into Germany, they could end the war quickly and be home by Christmas. It's a funny phrase, that one, because it comes up a lot in things I read about the war. Everybody wants to be home by Christmas. We'll have our boys home by Christmas.
Didn't happen.
No, Arnhem was a terrible disaster.
His filming in Arnhem, which was his first posting after he'd finished his training, what are the photographs like that he took there?
Well, he was supposed to go in as a cinematographer, and then at the last minute he was asked to take a still camera as well as a film camera, which he wasn't very happy about because he said, obviously, the person who suggested it didn't know that these were two entirely different mediums. And of course, the bulk, he was taking a Besser with a bellows opening, so that had to be unfolded to take a photograph, which wasn't very good in battle conditions either. So he leapt into battle, out of the plane, parachuted out with two cameras strapped to him and a pistol, and that was basically it. And I think if anyone who knows weaponry, which I didn't know anything about, but have learnt still that, you know, a pistol is not a great deal of help in a major battle like that. He was then having to switch between the still camera and the cine camera for as long as he had film, and because Arnhem was such a disaster and they never met up with the land army and nothing happened the way it should have, of course he only had limited amount of film as well. One thing that's interesting is in his war diary there's a lot of still photographs, and they are the still photographs that he took, but when I look at them compared to the other still photographer that was there, they're very grainy and there's a lot of movement in them, and you can see, well, it's interesting for me because I know that he was a cinematographer, so it's really got that sense of action in them. They're not so smoothly composed as the other photographers.
And what are the subjects? Is it soldiers? Is it actual battle scenes? What are those photos of?
Some of the earlier material, certainly the film, is of soldiers marching up towards Arnhem from where they landed, and soldiers deployed around Wolfies, close to where they originally landed. But later on, when they become surrounded and are under siege by the Germans at Oosterbeek, the photographs are then of individual soldiers, you know, soldiers in trenches drinking water, soldiers firing 3-inch mortars, things like that.
Were there restrictions on what he could film or photograph?
There were no instructions that I've ever seen that gave them any restrictions as to what they could film or what they shouldn't film. They also had to fill out caption sheets about what they filmed, and there was a censor actually with them at Arnhem, but I think he was mostly concerned with what the BBC and the other journalists were broadcasting. And when the material was sent back to the War Office, they would decide what could be used and what could be sent out to the newsreels and so on. So there was a censorship there. But it's interesting that when I went and I saw the German footage of Arnhem, then you realise that in the British footage, there are no British dead shown. So they did not film their own dead, and they didn't film that many dead Germans when I think about it in that. Another researcher who I've talked to who worked in this area thought that this was just an unwritten thing that they decided for themselves, because they basically knew that it wouldn't be used. I mean, they weren't going to broadcast the fact that, you know, there were all these British dead.
And
I
maybe
know,
a kind of a respect for their friends too, not wanting to photograph what would be often awful final moments.
Yes, I think there probably was some of that too, although there was an incident in Arnhem which made me think about that, because I know that one or two of them did take some fairly graphic photos of dead Germans and their own. And the one incident that my father described, which is horrific, is of a young officer who was spotting for a gun, and he was hit by a flamethrower, and he describes how he ran back towards them, basically burnt to death, but still standing and shouting out, "Shoot me, shoot me, please shoot me." And the photographer, he said, did take a photo of that. but I've never seen it, and I wonder, it probably wasn't ever developed.
Are there photos of your dad as well at this time? When you look back, can you see the young Mike?
Yes, it's interesting. One of the things excited me when I was starting the research was looking on the website of the Imperial War Museum and finding out that there was even a piece of film of him on the way to Arnhem. And then when I looked at the film that the other cameraman who was there had taken, I could see him just on the edge of the frame. And also the photographer did take a few pictures of him. And there's a particularly lovely one, which must have been fairly early on because they were only there for 9 days, when the three of them had stopped for lunch and he's sitting on the back of the vehicle eating out of a tin, and another one is there accepting a cup of tea or coffee or I don't know what from one of the local women who had come out to see them.
In early 1945, your dad was in Europe. Why was he sent to the Nazi camp at Bergen-Belsen?
The Allies had finally crossed the Rhine in 1945 into Germany, and they were pushing into Germany and fanning out now. Really, it was, everyone knew this was the end. They were mopping up. They had reached Celle, a small town close by, and they'd found some prisoners there who'd been terribly treated. And then they were reassigned. He was reassigned with several other cameramen and said that they were going to go to a camp at a place called Bergen-Belsen, and they'd been told that it was a camp for political prisoners and criminals, and that the camp was being taken over by the British under a truce because the camp had an outbreak of typhus and they didn't want that to spread into the community. So at the time, my father thought, well, sounds a bit dull, but, you know, maybe better go than going with the front line, because a lot of the Army Film and Photographic Unit travelled with the front line and they had actually quite high casualty rates.
So would Allied soldiers like your dad have had any idea about the sort of things that were happening in the Nazi camps?
I think they did have a little bit of an idea. I mean, we know that the authorities knew about it as early perhaps as 1941, what was happening in some of those camps. And there were rumours, unsubstantiated, and I guess there'd been reports here and there. But not for the soldiers, it would still have been unsubstantiated. So they weren't prepared for what they were going to see at all, really.
Was Belsen a concentration camp like Auschwitz? What sort of camp was it?
Belsen wasn't a concentration camp like Auschwitz because it wasn't an extermination camp. It was, I think, set up as an exchange camp. In fact, it was a camp used for Russian prisoners early on, and then later for Jews that they thought might be valuable as bargaining chips in exchanging for German prisoners and so on. I mean, you can name these camps whatever you like, exchange camps or labour camps or extermination camps. I think they all led in one direction for the inmates.
Did it have gas chambers?
No, it didn't. It had a crematoria there where they burnt the bodies. It's interesting that probably when Joseph Kramer, the commandant of the camp, took over, things took a turn for the worst. Now, he had been running Auschwitz, so he had perhaps different ideas about how the camp should run. There was a deliberate policy of starvation and neglect and brutality there to increase the reduction of the population.
And how significant was disease at Belsen?
By the time the British got there, there were probably 10,000 dead lying unburied in the camps. So what had happened is these inmates who were already badly starved had no food for 9 days and no water for four. And many of them had been locked up in filthy huts in terrible conditions, so they couldn't go anywhere to relieve themselves. They were infested with lice, and the lice had spread typhus through the camps, and there were other things, diphtheria and cholera and so on. So people were dying at a huge rate when the British got there.
How many people were in Belsen in 1945?
I think around 60,000. The camp wasn't designed to take that many prisoners, but because of the Allies pushing through, particularly the Russians in the east, they did what was called the death marches, where they marched the prisoners from the east back into Germany, and a lot of them were sent to Belsen, and so they just kept cramming more and more people in there, which made the conditions much worse.
So it was this camp of around 60,000 people, at least 10,000 people dead, that your dad appeared at?
Yes, and I've always tried to imagine how that was, driving in on that first evening they arrived, on the very day that the British had taken over. I think in the morning they arrived in the evening, the cameramen in their vehicle, and drove through. And it was a camp that covered about 55 hectares, I think. It had 9 huge watchtowers, 2-metre-high barbed wire fences. And as they drove through, there were different compounds for keeping perhaps different nationalities, keeping the women and the men separate. And as they drove through into the camp, the first thing before they even got into the camp was the smell, the stench of decay and rotting bodies and urine and excrement and all the other appalling things that they were going to see. And then as they drove in, there were dead bodies along the road, mostly naked, because they'd be stripped by the inmates because they needed the clothes themselves, or they wanted to burn them for a fire to keep warm. And there were people who were close to death too, who were so badly emaciated, such skin and bones, that they looked barely alive themselves.
What did he tell you, or what did he remember about the first contact with those people who were still alive in those conditions?
One thing he did say, he said that when he made contact with some of the inmates there and he tried to talk to them a bit, I think he had a bit of Barmy German, or he might have known a bit of Yiddish or something like that, and they found out that he was a Jew, they were amazed. And he said they were eating me up with their eyes because they couldn't believe that he was a Jew and that he was free. And I think it was at that point that the ones who realised this, they really understood that, you know, liberation had come.
What did he film?
The filming went on for 10 days. They thought they would just go in and leave, I suppose, and then their commanding officer came in and said that they should stay there, and he wanted a full record made of the camp and the efforts there that the British were making to bring relief. So they stayed there for 10 days. They went in every day filming, and he filmed the bodies, and he filmed the people being given food, and he filmed the guards being put to work collecting and burying bodies, and he filmed the huge pits of bodies being filled. And as the time went on, the weather was, it was May, it was getting warmer, the people were still dying at a huge rate. The decision was made to use bulldozers to push the bodies into these pits because they could no longer pick up the bodies and carry them. And it's probably some of the most disturbing footage of the Belsen archive, because to see bodies treated in that way is horrific, and to see the bulldozers tumbling them into the pit, in it's such a desecration, so far removed from how we normally think of treating bodies with respect. And the men who were there, these hardened combat cameramen, some of whom had been on the beach at Normandy, were devastated, devastated, as of course was my father.
Did they write about what they were seeing, or was everything focused on taking those photographs and the filming?
So the interesting thing about the Belsen archive, the images, is that if you read their caption sheets tell a story of men who were struggling, to my way of thinking, they were struggling to frame what they were seeing and to describe what they were seeing. In fact, the impression I got is that they all felt they needed to explain more with their photographs, that the film and photographs weren't enough. So most of them start with a lengthy exposition about what they found there and what it was like. And In fact, a lot of the descriptions that come from those early days of Bergen-Belsen start with, "You won't believe what I'm telling you. You'll just never believe this. I hardly believe it myself."
So it were these images that you found in the envelope in the suitcase at your family home?
Yes. So that's where I came full circle, I suppose. I often think, where do stories start? And did it start with me finding those? It really did start with me finding those photographs, or did it start with my father? It's really hard to say. But for me, the story started with finding those photographs. And the five large photographs, as I came to realise and I came to understand them a bit more, are in fact, they're very small in number compared with the amount of footage that was taken and the number of photographs. But they basically encapsulate that first 10 days of my father's experience. Now I understand them as an adult, this large landscape of Belsen that one of the men had taken, where you see the watchtowers and the people in these grimy conditions and taking water from a standpipe and things like that. You see bodies being picked up and carried. You see the pit with the bodies in it. And the one that really struck me was of a close-up of a man who died of starvation. You see him very close and you see all the hollow out of his eyes and the little bit of bristle of his beard and his open mouth, his barrel of ribs and his hollowed out abdomen and the blade bones sticking through the skin. It's like a leitmotif of Belsen, because when you look at the film and other photographs, they're everywhere, bodies like this, everywhere. And that particular photograph for me is meaningful for many reasons, but it kind of personalizes on the scale of the thing where there are so many bodies and such desecration. To see one individual like that brings it back to the personal, brings it back to a life that was taken, I think.
Why do you think your dad kept those photographs in that suitcase?
It's early in my research. My brother asked me that question. Why would anybody want to keep those horrific reminders?
Because it's not like he'd ever forget. You imagine that would have been scarred into his memory forever.
Oh, absolutely. I don't think he went looking at them very often. And when I met one of his comrades who was there, Harry Oakes, he also had a bundle of photographs that he brought out for me to see. And my brother said, you know, why would you keep them? Why would you keep them? And I thought about it a lot over a period of time. And then I came to realize that they needed to keep them because they were evidence and they were proof and they were reminders of what they'd seen, and maybe proof against the time when somebody would say, oh, it didn't happen that way, or it wasn't that bad, or maybe you don't remember it right, or something like that. They had that need to be able to corroborate their memories in some way. Indeed, the film was used as evidence in a war crimes trial. There's another aspect that I found in those photographs for myself, is that there's the witnessing, the evidence, the illustrative, but there's also a remembrance aspect to them. Because when I think about it, all those people buried in these graves with no names and no one to actually mark their passing, we would never know they existed at all if we didn't have these photographs. We'd just have these mounds, these grave mounds, and that would be all.
In later life, when your dad was living in Australia and got interviewed about his experiences, what effect did it have on him, Helen, to remember being at Belsen, to talk about what he experienced there in those first days after liberation?
I called in to see him after the last of his interviews, and when looking back, I was very superficial in my understanding of what he went through. It sort of mortifies me a bit now, because I was surprised that he was so overcome. He was sitting there and I could see in his face he'd been almost in tears, and he kept dabbing at his nose, you know, and he said to me, why do I have to keep telling this over and over again? Isn't it enough I took the film? Wasn't that enough? But I think he always knew that it wasn't enough, that on their own, without provenance, without context, that they weren't enough. And so he willingly told the story over and over again because it was a story that needed to be told.
Where's that suitcase now?
Well, I still have that suitcase. I've just recently been packing the layers again, repacking it, and I'm hoping that it will go to a museum because I think it's a very important archive. It's important to be there for people into the future. One of the things I recently discovered, and you're always discovering it, and I'm sure I haven't unlocked everything that is to be unlocked in that archive, there's probably more there, is that the suitcase itself is actually a military footlocker. I think the British would have called it just a military trunk, but the Americans called it a footlocker. It's what soldiers would get to keep their personal belongings in, probably their wills and things like that when they were deployed.
This story of what your dad went through and you retracing his steps, trying to imagine yourself into him, really, to see through the lens the way that he did, I mean, that's consumed you for years. Where do you get respite? Where's your joy and peace and moments of breathing out amid all of this?
I think my breathing out was when the book was published, finally. It's been a quest, let's say it's been a quest. I don't think I could have sustained it that long if it hadn't been a quest. I felt that if I could set the story down, it would ease his burden of remembering, because there was that burden of witnessing, and I've shared that a bit with him, and now I can put it down as well and let the book go into the world and tell the story.
I think your dad would be very proud. Helen Lewis, thank you for being my guest.
Thank you for having me.
Helen Lewis's book is The Dead Still Cry Out, The Story of a Combat Cameraman. Details at our website, abc.net.au/conversations. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.